happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. We have people listening all over the planet, almost in every country. And as a result, we try to select the information, the issues, the audio clips, the in-depth discussions, the guests that can harmonize with your needs. For example, today we're going to talk about how cacao or chocolate, as well as tea, green tea, white tea, black tea, have compounds in them that will slash your heart disease and death rate by 40%. And that's from Wageningen University. Also, we're going to talk about wheat. I'm going to give you more information than the average person knows about gluten. Why gluten is a problem. Why it didn't used to be a problem, but it is today. Then we're going to talk about how copper is very essential. University of California, Berkeley talks about how it helps you burn fat. Then there's an issue that I haven't seen discussed, but it's important. How early puberty, and we're talking about very early puberty, is a big physiological disadvantage for young girls. Why? Now, 100 years ago, most girls were getting their period at 16, 17, or even 18. Today, as young as 7. What's that mean? How did that happen? I'll share that in our public health segment. Also today, from David Hunter and Joel Leitner, we're going to talk about the planet's food supply could be saved by a kind of bee you probably have never heard of. Now, I'm a beekeeper. I've taught all about bees and have had as many as 144 hives. But you don't need but one hive. But what kind of bees you're going to have? What kind do you think are out there? Well, you may think that, well, there's the honeybee. Yeah, there is the honeybee, and that's important, but there are 4,000 other variety native to North America. And there's thousands of species of bees around the world. But there's one bee above all that actually does most of the pollinating that we never hear about. So I'll tell you about that. And you don't have to have many of them. In fact, just one single one of these bees will pollinate all types of fruit trees and flowers. So I'll tell you what kind that is and how you could actually get them, put them in your backyard, or maybe get a hive and put them on in the school area as a school project. So that's very good. Then we're going to take a look at some important issues around the world. Last Friday, I concluded a four-part series of conversations with remarkable minds that dealt with one topic only for 4 hours by one scholar, Danny Sheehan. And it dealt with the most powerful people in the world, the wealth masters, and they're behind a whole movement, and they're very patient. And we're seeing the manifestation of that movement. For example, the European Union was part of their projects. But you wouldn't know that. So we're going to talk about this deep government, the people behind the people that you see and vote for, behind the foundations and the institutions and the banks. And so what I'm doing over the next month, each week I'm going to play an extended audio clip that takes you closer and closer to seeing which institutions they control, what policies they're putting forward, how they're controlling the media, and by extension, our lives. I want us to learn in the larger historical context. So this is our history lessons that help us with important current social issues. For example, this week I'm going to do a long clip, a brilliant clip, on why people in the United Kingdom should say yes, get out of the European Union. That vote is coming up in 2 weeks, and it's very close. But if people knew what's in this clip and who's behind the European Union and how they're taking away your sovereignty and how you no longer have any rights and how the laws in your own country will no longer prevail, then you would quickly say, get out. And with you getting out, other countries will follow. And hopefully then that would collapse the entire European Union, which should happen, where countries go back to their own currencies, their own economic standards and standard of living and governance. That's one that we'll be having. But we have a lot of those coming up in depth. Also something you've never heard before. You've never heard broadcast before. We have been inundated over the last 15 years with articles on the internet claiming that there are FEMA camps that are meant to house not just illegal aliens, but Americans who are considered a threat. And of course, all that has been completely wiped away as conspiracy, irresponsible statements, no validity. None whatsoever. There are no internment camps, or none planned. You know, it's like saying that, you know, we never landed on the moon. Well, not true. But we always wait until we have absolute, irrefutable, scholarly, presented in a court of law evidence. And we have it. So tell your friends now. Later in today's program, they will hear absolute, irrefutable proof that is there for them to validate themselves. They have planned camps, and these are not just way stations. These are permanent camps. And who's supposed to go into them? And how many? And what's supposed to happen when they're in them? You won't believe what you're going to hear exclusively today on this program. But it is 100% backed up. First up today, we're going to talk about chocolate. Now, when I talk about chocolate, always look to see, is it fair trade chocolate? Because a lot of chocolate is grown where the people actually are slaves. And nobody should be eating chocolate where they don't know the source of it. Now, is it going to be an extra effort, extra cost? You bet. Because you got to make sure that the people who are harvesting it and growing it are being given a fair wage. So that's responsible chocolate. Then get a chocolate that doesn't have all kinds of sugars and milk and all kinds of chemicals in it. Get the healthiest chocolate. And get a non-GMO, gluten-free chocolate, an organic chocolate. Here's the latest. This is from a university in the Netherlands. Quote, long-term consumption of epicatechin, E-P-I, catechin, C-A-T-E-C-H-I-N. That's a compound found in tea. By the way, also found in apple skins and cacao or chocolate. Quote, can significantly boost heart health and reduce your risk of heart-related death. Data from the study, the Zupfen Elderly Study, over 25 years, data was collected, and they found that you have 30% lower risk of dying from coronary heart disease than men with the lowest average intakes of the epicatechin or the chemicals that are in naturally occurring in chocolate, green tea, and apples. Scientists at the University also reported that epicatechin intake was also significantly associated with lower risk of dying from cardiovascular disease in men who were suffering from it. Quote, to our knowledge, this is the first prospective cohort study to examine specifically the association between dietary epicatechin intake and cardiovascular mortality. And they published it in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Now, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of studies on how your body is helped when you eat an apple, or you have chocolate, or you have green tea. In green tea alone, there are over 5,000 studies. So, quote, previous cohort studies have focused on total flavin-3-all monomer intake and showed conflicting results. And this one didn't. So they looked at all these men over 25 years and came away with the idea you're going to have a lot less likelihood of dying of a heart attack or stroke if you have an apple a day, some green or white or black tea a day, and have yourself some chocolate, maybe 2 ounces, each day. How much is 2 ounces? It'd fit in a tablespoon. It's small. I'm going to share more information from Green Med Info on gluten, because I'm asked this question all the time. Because the very first thing I do when I'm putting people on a healthy protocol, I always say, here's a list of the foods and beverages you should not have in any amount. And then I tell them what they can have and give them lists. So there's more that they can have. There's always an abundance, things they never thought they would ever want to eat or even have ever eaten, because we're creatures of habit. And they say, why wheat? Haven't we always had bread and wheat? Yeah, we have, but it's completely different. Even I tell them, even when I'm traveling in Europe, and especially in Italy, and especially in the country, where when you're driving down a road, you get out of a car, and in fact, what I did is I'd have my buddies and my brothers who went with me, and my buddies are medical doctors who are also Italian, and hence they speak fluent Italian. I don't. And I would run. I would do my marathon training. I'd run 20, 25 miles. And in that 20, 25 miles, I would go through probably 3 to 4 hamlets, small little townships that may comprise of 6 to 15 homes. But those homes have been there a long time. And you can smell the oldness. It's like going into, going into one of the compounds of Valley Forge, or going into Monticello, or some of the other homes that are now museums. You can smell it. And some of these homes were 800 years old. I was in one home that was 800 years old. Still had the original beams and the stone. And you find the people are generally vitally healthy. And you don't see microwaves. What you do see, you see racks. Now, for those of you who are baby boomers, you remember clotheslines, right? You go out and you pin up have a wooden pin, you pin up your sheets and your clothes, and they dry in the sun, which is healthy, by the way. One of the reasons we never realized today, it was so much healthier to dry your clothes out in the sun, because the sun is a great natural killer bacteria and viruses. Yeah. Plus the natural winds carry different fragrances from the blossoms. So if you happen to have dandelion or, let's say, chrysanthemums, your linen would frequently have that wonderful smell because it would be picked up. And you take it in. And a neighbor had had wonderful lilac. And lilac's just one of those magnificent smells. And everything smelled like lilac. So in any case, I'm seeing racks, but I don't see the clothes. I see wheat. I see pastas. So you go over and you have 2 or 3 different types of pasta hanging on a rack drying. Put them in your hand. They're soft. They're pliable. And then after a day in the sun, they dry. And then they roll them into like little balls, like you would see a ball of yarn. And they then put them into different containers. And they just mark on them the date. And because they know how long they've had it, which ones they have. I saw one kitchen that had over 200 different jars. They had all types of mushrooms. They also had pastas. They had pasta sauces. They had garlics of different types and garlics that were marinated. They had different sauces. They had probiotics galore. They had like 9 different types of fermented foods. We don't do that. We don't see that. Oh, yeah, if you go into a health food store, you can find some of these, but not in the average person's home. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm allergic to wheat, but I know my allergy. I'll get my nose and ears will get a little red. My throat will get a little bit raspy, but in about 2 hours, I'll take quercetin and I'll take some cayenne capsule, and then it'll neutralize it. I want to taste their food. It's healthy. It's organic. I want to see how they cook it. So I was in the kitchen watching them cook, all slow cooking, all slow, nothing high temperature. And it's a whole ritual, and these people know how to cook. Now, the French are given the credit for being the finest gourmet cooks, but for me, the Italians, the Cretes, would be the healthiest cooking. And so I'm watching how they make their sauces, how they're dipping the tomatoes in the hot water, then peeling off the skins, which herbs they use, and how they take the herbs not all at once. Like here in America, everything goes in one, boom, it's all in. No, that's not the way you do it. There are certain herbs that you start off with, and then you add other herbs as something cooks. Then you have your final herbs in the last 2 minutes, and that's what gives this wonderful flavor quality. So anyhow, I started asking about the wheat, and I had a pasta dish, but I had a small serving. And lo and behold, nothing happened. So the next day I did it again at a different place. Nothing happened. So I'm thinking, am I no longer allergic to gluten or wheat, or is it how it's grown? Because in America, you know, you could have pesticides, you could have the different types of processing. When I got back to America, yeah, still had the allergy, so clearly it was how they grew it, how they processed it. Well, most folks don't realize that when we're talking about health problems associated with wheat or gluten, we're not talking about a monolithic entity, a singular bad guy solely responsible for the havoc commonly experienced as a consequence of consuming this one grain. After all, how could just one villain cause the 200-plus different clinically observed adverse health effects now linked in the biomedical literature to wheat consumption? No, the problem is that gluten is an abstraction. What do I mean? I mean, in its perceived singularity, profoundly misrepresents the true extent of the problem, much in the way that the tip of an iceberg does not convey the massive threat submerged below. First, let's get with the basics. Gluten's name comes from glue and signifies the doughy complex of proteins within the wheat plant, further classified as either a gladins, which are alcohol-soluble, or glutalins, which dilute acid or alkali soluble, or other. And because wheat is a what is called a hexaploid species, meaning it, well, the byproduct of three ancestor plants becoming one, with no less than 6 sets of chromosomes and 6.5 times more genes than found in the human genome. Yeah, it's capable of producing no less than 23,780 different proteins. That's just mind-numbing. Well, any one of these proteins could elicit what is known as an antigenic response. That means the immune system identifies wheat protein as other, launches either an innate or adaptive immune response, and attacks self-destructure accidentally as a result. So, if only one protein could incite an adverse reaction, what could 23,000 different proteins do when presented to the body for processing simultaneously? And what if many of these wheat proteins were bonded proteins, that is, glued together? What would happen is that many of these proteins would pass through our intestinal tract, made more permeable by the dual effects of the gliadin and wheat lectin, the invisible thorn, hence opening Pandora's breadbox, an autoimmunity and systemic inflammation. Because what do you see when you are counseling someone, all the dietitians and nutritionists listening right now, we have many, when people start talking about they have bloating and gas and indigestion and they feel weak after a meal, and generally after a meal that has had wheat, they have some burning sensation in the feet, or they have pain and swelling in the ankles, the knees, the elbows, joint places, almost always has a red flag saying they're having an autoimmune response where the body is actually attacking itself. And almost always you're going to find that they have had sugar in the diet, they have had sometimes alcohol in the diet, and they do not chew their food thoroughly. As a result, only partially digested particulates, meaning they haven't created what is, as you eat foods, is called bolus. It's mechanically eaten with some enzymes under the tongue. But once in the stomach, it's supposed to become chyme, C-H-Y-M-E, which is like, a potato soup. That's the consistency of perfectly digested food going from the intestine in, from the stomach into the intestine. Because the more complete your digestion, the more you've chewed the food, the better the mastication, the slower you've eaten it, the less liquid you consume, the better the digestion, absorption, utilization, and elimination of the food. We get in the habit of eating agitated, anxious, watching a movie, listening to radio, and we're not paying attention to how many times we're chewing. As a result, we chew, gulp, or we have a liquid. And think how many people have a soft drink, which in and of itself creates phosphoric acid going in and meeting with hydrochloric acid, and then you get hyperacidic reaction. And then you take an antacid, which you shouldn't do, that then kills the digestion completely, and now you get large particles of food going into the intestine, and that's what ends up being absorbed through our leaky gut, because we haven't been taking glutamine. We haven't been taking alpha-lipoic acid, the R fraction. We haven't been taking the probiotics. So we haven't built up. We haven't taken aloe vera to calm and to heal our intestine stomach. We haven't drank cabbage juice or eaten sauerkraut. So we end up with this. And now you're taking gluten, and that's one of the 23,000 proteins. It's a very large number, and given the recombinational possibilities inherent in such a large number of distinct different proteins, some of them have emerged by sheer accident as nearly identical in structure and configuration to both narcotic drugs and virulent components of immune system activating microbes. Now, what do I mean? What do I mean by narcotic potential? Gliadin can be broken down into various amino acid links or peptides. And gliadimorphin is a 7 amino acid long peptide, long tongue twister, which forms when the gastrointestinal system is compromised. And when digestive enzymes are insufficient to break down the gliadorphin down into 2 or 3 amino acid links, and a compromised intestinal wall allows for the leakage of the entire 7 amino acid long fragment into the blood, then the gliadorphin can pass through the brain through what is called a circumventricular organ and activate opiate receptors, resulting in disrupted brain function. Hence, when a lot of people are taking in gluten, they manifest psychotic, neurotic, delusional, or paranoid behavior, or hyper-agitated behavior. So what if you, as a parent, give your kid a sandwich, and the sandwich has been made from wheat, gluten, and afterwards they look or act agitated? Now you understand. The kid's brain has been impacted like a narcotic. It can also create a sedative effect. where people just zone out, can't focus, can't concentrate, can't remember. They've lost the ability for full cognitive power. So there have been a number of gluten exophorins identified, gluten exophorin A4, A5, B4, B5, and C, and many of them have been hypothesized to play a role in autism, schizophrenia, ADHD, and related neurological conditions. In the same way that the celiac iceberg illustrated the illusion that intolerance to wheat is rare. It is possible, even probable, that wheat exerts pharmacological influences on everyone. What distinguishes one from another is the degree to which we are affected. And also it has immunotoxic potential. The digestion of gliadin produces a peptide that is 33 amino acids long and is known as 33-mer, which has a remarkable capacity for intestinal sequencing and its immunodominant sequence in many different ways can then absolutely knock your immune system down. So the next time someone says, well, there's nothing wrong with wheat, yeah, there is, unless the wheat has not been sprayed with glyphosate, which can cause it to become toxic, unless you have a really healthy intestinal system, and it's organic, and if it's not overprocessed. But since you're not going to be in Italy in the mountains anytime soon, just go to the gluten-free grains. And finally, copper, according to the University of California, Berkeley, is deficient in most people who are overweight. Small amounts of copper are necessary. Beans and nuts are good sources. And what copper does, it helps with our metabolism. And in fact, some studies have shown that copper boosts fat burning. So that's what this study at University of California did, and it was published in the Nature Chemical Biology. So you don't need a lot of copper. 2 milligrams can do the trick. Now, for our public health comments, this is from Martha Rosenberg from Alternet. It's an article I reposted on our website called Early Puberty in Girls is Becoming Epidemic and Getting Worse. Quote, padded bras for kindergartners with growing breasts to make them more comfortable. 16% of U.S. girls experiencing breast development by the age of 7. 30% of the age of 8. Clearly something is affecting the hormones of U.S. girls, a phenomenon also seen in other developed countries. Girls in poorer countries seem to be spared until they move to a developed country. No scientists dispute the precocious or early onset puberty. It's on the rise, but they don't agree on the reasons. Is it bad diet, lack of exercise that cause growing obesity? Is it soft drinks themselves, even when not linked to obesity? Is it the chemicals known as endocrine disruptors that exert estrogen-like effects? Is it the many legal, unlabeled hormones used in the U.S. to fatten livestock? Is it stress? Now, puberty in girls is defined by 3 things, breast development, appearance of pubic hair, and the onset of menstrual periods. And in the 1700s, girls did not menstruate until age 17 to 18. 100 years ago, the average age when a girl got her first period was 17. Quote, the reason why weight matters is because when the body senses it has extra calories, enough to sustain a pregnancy, the fat tissues release a signal into the bloodstream. And that signal then travels to the brain, telling it that sexual development is a go. Doctors see the opposite happening in girls who suffer from anorexia. When the body is starved of calories, the first thing that it shuts off are the sex hormones. Leptin, L-E-P-T-I-N, a protein produced by fatty tissue and believed to regulate fat storage in the body, is also a factor. Fat children have high levels of the protein leptin, which through a complicated chain involves the hypothalamus and pituitary gland can stimulate the release of the 3 main hormones in puberty. And that is not good. So what's wrong with precocious puberty? Well, there are many reasons why this is undesirable. Girls with early maturation are at risk of low self-esteem and higher rates of depression. They're more likely to be influenced by older peers and more deviant peers and initiate intercourse and substance abuse and other norm-breaking behaviors at younger ages. And that's according to the journal Pediatrics. The biologic impact of earlier maturation includes greater risk of several cancers, including breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and endometrial cancer, as well as hyperinsulinemia and hypertension, high blood pressure, and obesity. Heart disease also is increased substantially. And the earlier occurrence, quote, of puberty shortens the duration of pre-puberty growth in a fashion that is not compensated for by an increase in peak amplitude. That's according to Oxford University Journal on it. Now, it is my belief that one of the most common causes of this is the amount and type of meat that young girls are eating. You've seen the commercials. We've all seen them. They're giving you more types of processed meat. And these processed meats, and almost all of them now have bacon on them, and then they have different types of cold cuts, hamburgers. This is all chemically treated. It's all high in carcinogens. The way they cook it at high temperatures means it has heterocyclic amines. The bun has acrylamides. It is an absolute nutritional disaster to eat any of these. And yet, this is the norm. In fact, now, to outdo the competition, they want to put everything on it. They want to put a hamburger, then cheese, then bacon on top of that. And so you're getting more. But none of it is healthy. All of it's got hormones in it because the chickens were fed hormones, the beef was fed hormones, lots of hormones. So, in fact, there was a study, I found the peer-reviewed literature from Public Health Nutrition, of 3,000 girls that were in this, that ate eight portions of meat a week by the age of 3, and 12 portions of meat a week, which is common, by age of 7, they were likely to have an early start of menstruation. In fact, the girls were 75% more likely to have begun their periods by the age of 12 if they had been eating a high-meat diet when they were 7 years old. And that was done at the University of Brighton. So you add in the junk food, the sugar, onto the meat, and you've got an ingestion of chemicals and hormones. And that is why I believe, including dairy, that we have this epidemic. So just remember, please understand this. Overweight girls are more likely to develop breast cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, heart disease, and arthritis. So what we're feeding them will shorten their lives and put them at risk of all forms of conditions. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now, quickly for our environmental segment, this is from Dave Hunter and Joe Leitner from Mountaineer Books. People hear the word beekeeping and they imagine the picture, you know, honey beekeepers in white helmeted suits. By the way, yes, many of those do, but for those of us who know the bees and have had bees for decades, and lots of them, never once stung. And in fact, I remember, I'm wondering if anyone in the audience remembers back to when every weekend in the summer at my old Fertiller farm upstate New York at Stone Ridge, that I would have a small group of people from the audience come up to learn crafts. How to make tofu and how to bake asim breads and how to grow organically. It was a wonderful time. And we'd sit around the campfire. We'd have like 7 picnic tables filled with different dishes, sometimes 30 different entrees to select from. And we had folk singing at night and nature walks and swimming in the lake. It was, to me, it was just one of the greatest opportunities possible to share good energy with the audience. And one of the things we shared, go down the beehives, open up the beehive, we'd be sitting there, and take the bees out and show them that how you get the honey out of a beehive. And, of course, we never used the honey. I always put it out in the wintertime so the bees would have food all winter long, so we didn't have any colony collapse. And how to make sure, you know, that nothing is around the base, and how to put garlic around the base and cayenne pepper that kills a lot of the bugs that otherwise get into the beehive. Anyhow, do any of you remember that? Any of you remember being at those for 14 years, all summer, those wonderful weekends where we learned so much, and beehives and how to be guardians of the bees was an important part of that because they're great pollinators. Anyhow, if you do, just email me and let me know what your experiences were, what you remember from that. But we've always heard that, you know, the bee is the honeybee. There are thousands of species of bees. And what we never talk about is the bee that probably does more pollinating than the others, because it's a loner, and it works alone. And I want to give you a little information on it, because some of you may want to try this in your own backyards or your schools. And it goes by different names. The name Mason bee, M-A-S-O-N-B, it can be referred to a number of species, but it's the Osmia, O-S-M-I-A, genus of bees. And they can use the soil. They can make their material for their homes out of in nests and plants, unlike a regular bee, a honeybee. And they live in different places in different parts of North America. And they're also called orchard mason bees or blue orchard bees or orchard bees or spring mason bees. It's all the same. And these are the real busy pollinators. And honeybees are designed to capture the pollen and bring it back to their nests. And they are well suited to do that because they can put it in their these little like little sleeves under their legs and bring them back. And pollination is accidental because they want to get the majority of that pollen back to the hive. And so they're very neat. The mason bee, on the other hand, just the opposite. It carries pollen back to the nest and has this fuzzy abdomen, and that's where it collects loosely, with a certain tendency to drop off the bee's fuzzy belly as they go across one plant after another. So they just walk on one flower, walk on a fruit bud, and they're brushing it on one to the other. And so they're doing an enormous amount of pollinating. And because when they fly, then a lot of that blows off and blows onto other plants. So their fuzzy bellies and here and there flying habits make mason and leafcutter bees truly exceptional pollinators. Honeybees may get the attention in commercial crops, but part of the reason is that their beekeepers end the pollinating season with products they can sell, namely honey and beeswax, because these earn a relatively high price per pound for a small farmer keeping his own bees. There's an obvious appeal. But the case of a large agricultural operation, chances are they'll be just hiring the honeybee pollinator service and nothing else. But the mason bee gathers pollen dry all over its body, with much of it falling off on each flower they touch. And the fastidious honeybee doesn't do that. So if you have a small amount of land, even just a backyard, or you have a few trees in an orchard, you want the mason bee. The mason bees are a wonderful alternative. One single mason bee can pollinate enough cherry blossoms to net 12 pounds, that's 5.4 kilograms, of fresh cherries. In comparison, a cherry orchardist needs 60 honeybees with the same size harvest. So shows you don't need many of these bees to get things pollinated. And that's what you're getting, pollen. And most of us are not serious orchardists. Perhaps you have a fruit tree or some berry bushes, or have been thinking about adding one or another to your garden. Depending upon what you have, you might even think your pollination needs and already are being met, because many fruit trees and berry bushes sold today are labeled self-pollinating. That's not true. This leads to the assumption they do not actually need the presence of pollinating insects to help them along. This is an unfortunate error in communication, says only about 10% of plants are wild pollinated without any kind of assistance from insects or, less commonly, birds. What self-pollinating refers to is originally many kinds of berries and fruiting. Trees require two plants, one male, one female, to convert their flowers into any fruit at all. You relied upon the wind or native wild pollinators to transfer pollen back and forth between the flowers, and only the female plants would ultimately bear fruit. And self-pollinating means you do not need to worry about male and female plants, but you do still need to make sure that pollen moves around between the blossoms on your tree or shrubs. That is why encouraging effective pollinators in your garden can make such a big difference. And while mason bees drop a lot of pollen, they are so dedicated to crawling across flowers that the pollen dropping off their furry bellies lands right where you want it, on another flower. And so when the wind drops pollen, it's just as likely to blow down the street or onto a sidewalk as it is to land on another part of a fruit plant. And more pollen in the right place equals more reason for flowers to become fruit. Remember, you can't have an apple, you can't have an orange, you can't have a lemon, you can't have a plum until you first have a little tiny flower. And that's why if you have bees and they're walking across those flowers and they're picking up pollen and delivering pollen, then your female trees are going to bear fruit. And that's what you want. And that is from that mason bee. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health, healing, alternative approaches to doing something simple like making sure that we have more blossoms, more fruit in our society. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting video streaming from our studios in New York City. And a big shout out to the people up in Woodstock who are listening today, as they do each day. I'll be up there in the next 2 months to premiere my new documentary. More on that documentary coming up. I've got three documentaries in the works, and these are all new, and one's extraordinarily empowering. That's the first one I'll be presenting. Now, I want to thank the tremendous outpouring for the new health support group. We did not get into the protocols. It was just introduction, but it was a four-hour introduction. It was a long afternoon. And I always give an introduction to go over everything before we actually start, because it's not for everyone. A lot of people say, it's too much for me, too much change, can't do it. That's fine. And other people say, yeah, I'm ready for it. I'm ready to change. I need to change. Got to change. I've been putting it off. I listened to your show, but I didn't do what, you know, the suggestions you have. And now I got this, I got that, I got the other. I got to do something. And we're there to help them. This will be the most transformative workshop I've ever done, especially helping people with brain, memory loss, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, diabetes, depression, anxiety, high blood pressure. All these are because of our lifestyle and behavior. This is not a medical program. It is a lifestyle and behavior modification. So I'm guessing about 50 people stated that they they just couldn't do it after they heard how it's intense, meaning you got to make a lot of change. So we're going to make room for those who are going not to be back so others could, because we've been filled. That's why I haven't mentioned it. If you would like to join us, we will be meeting every other Saturday for the next 4 months. You can call 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198, if you'd like to be a part of this in a journey of real healing and a journey of real change. Now we're going to play something unique, something you have not heard. And this actually proves that the United States government and different departments have been working together to create, build, staff camps, and not for what they've said in the past about immigrants as holding places till they're either sent back to their country or released in the United States. No. These are for people who, it would imply, are activists, people who are now considered domestic threats. So it's not. This information is real. Please listen in.
Following video details the contents of a Department of Defense document entitled Internment and Resettlement Operations, also known as FM3-39.40. The document is 325 pages long and it is signed by Joyce E. Morrow, Administrative Assistant to the Secretary of the Army. It was created in 2010, however, has just been recently leaked to the public via the internet and can now be downloaded from multiple sources. In the description below, you'll find a download link for the document. I strongly encourage you to download it yourself and to verify everything that's being said here. The document outlines military procedures for internment and resettlement of civilians, and it describes the layout and the administration of these internment camps. It clearly states on page 38 that it applies within U.S. territory, and it specifically addresses the detainment of U.S. citizens, as is indicated by the identification procedures for new prisoners on page 146, which states that social security numbers are to be recorded alongside their photograph and fingerprints. Included in the list of organizations which may be involved in these internment operations are the Department of Homeland Security, FEMA, the Department of Defense, and the United Nations. On page 56, the document outlines the responsibilities of psychological operations officers within the camps, among which it states that a PSYOP officer develops and executes indoctrination programs to reduce or remove antagonistic attitudes and identifies political activists. On page 281, the document goes into more detail regarding the role of psychological operations within the camps, specifically in regards to pacifying the population and ensuring cooperation. On page 238, it gives the conditions for the use of deadly force in such camps. Among the justifications for lethal force, it includes to terminate an active escape attempt. That point right there should make it clear that these camps are not benevolent disaster relief type facilities. On page 244, the document calls for the use of snipers during riots to, quote, scan a crowd and identify agitators and riot leaders for apprehension and fire lethal rounds if warranted. On page 260, it shows the basic layout for a facility focusing on detainment. It is depicted with interrogation areas, tribunal areas, and mortuaries. Each detainment facility is designed to hold 4,000 prisoners, and they are depicted with multiple levels of barbed wire separating compartments within the facilities, with a double barbed wire fence enclosing them, and watched over by 24 guard towers. On page 261, the document depicts the layout for what they call civilian resettlement facilities, which are designed to house 8,000 people. Though it uses the word resettlement, the plans show multiple levels of barbed wire dividing the sections of the facility, with double barbed wire fencing on the outside, as well as 16 guard towers. On page 262, the layout for facilities designed for what they call non-compliant prisoners is shown. These camps are designed to hold up to 300 prisoners, they have 3 interrogation centers, and are guarded by 13 guard towers. Now, if there's any question whether these plans are active or just theoretical, this should be settled by the fact that the U.S. Army has been running ads for job positions in these camps since 2009, and apparently, they're still hiring. Once again, if you look in the description, you'll find all the links you need to verify this information. It's important to note here that this document was created in 2010, which was under the Obama administration, and it predates the NDAA of 2012, which authorized military detainment of U.S. citizens. This clearly shows a long-term agenda at work. If you believe that this is important information for people to know about, then please share this video with as many people as you can.
Okay, there you have it. So that's something that we should all be concerned with, especially when you add that to everything else we know about mass surveillance and anyone who shows up for any demonstration, anyone who is protesting online, signing petitions for animal rights, against GMOs, labeling of GMOs. You're now no better in the government's eyes than a domestic terrorist. Now, if you want to know how we got here, how did we get to this place, then at some point you're going to have to go to the archives and listen to the four-part Danny Sheehan series, because he laid it all out. Who these people were, what's their long-term agenda, that's just one small part of it. On upcoming programs, we'll have other tapes that take you further into this. And those living in the United Kingdom will be offering up this week all the reasons why you should vote yes, exit the European Union. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.